Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
Paying too much for your prescription medication. It's partly due to DIR fees, and we'll explain why they affect you. And getting ready to open winter warming shelters. But with COVID-19 still around, these services are looking for extra help. Plus, a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. Every day in the US, people pick up and pay for their prescription medications, and despite promises to bring those costs down, we've yet to see any real change occur. A few episodes ago, we told you about pharmacy benefit managers, the middlemen of the pharmacy world that are raking in billions of dollars in profits by inflating the cost of medications you're taking. But it doesn't end there, as PBMs are also charging drug companies and your local pharmacy something called DIR fees that you are paying for and in many cases are putting local pharmacies out of business. I caught up with Doug Hoy, CEO of the National Community Pharmacists Association. Doug, welcome back to Connecticut East This Week.
Thanks, Brian. Pleasure to be back.
So you've launched a campaign called The Truth About PBMs. Tell us about it.
Yes, we've launched this campaign, like you said, called The Truth. And frankly, it's because there are so many misconceptions, or actually little conceptions, about PBMs. They're these enormous companies. They have been recently, in the last couple of years, acquired by large insurance companies. But they're enormous companies that have a huge effect on the health of consumers throughout the country. And many people don't know about the impact they have on their pocketbooks or their health. And so we're launching this campaign to help consumers, help legislators, help policymakers understand the enormous influence these corporate middlemen are having on the health and physical health and economic health of consumers.
Now, I want to delve into one particular aspect with you, because obviously this is a multifaceted campaign, but one of the things is called direct and indirect remuneration fees, or DIR fees, as they're known in the industry. Many people will not even know what those are. They've never come across them, a little bit like PBMs. Can you explain to us what DIR fees are, and why, as a consumer who's listening to this, will be saying to themselves, so why am I interested in this?
Absolutely. And this is one of the ways in which PBMs take advantage of the Byzantine pharmacy payment system, because it is so complex and there are so many different places to hide the ball, if you will, that it adds cost to consumers without them even knowing how or why. They just know that drugs cost a lot. So the way that pharmacy DIRs work is, so there are two sets of rebates that PBMs receive. Better known are the rebates that drug manufacturers have to pay to PBMs. So if a drug manufacturer wants its drug to be included on the PBM's formulary, which means that's the preferred drugs that the PBM insurance will pay for, then it has to pay the PBM a rebate. Those rebates average about 30%, which amounts to over $100 billion that are paid from the drug manufacturer to the PBM. So that's the drug manufacturer rebates. They're better known. They, you know, for those who follow this closely, that does make it into media reports occasionally. Lesser known are pharmacy DIR, where the pharmacy has to pay a rebate, essentially a rebate, to the PBM. Those rebates are also billions of dollars that go to the PBM. So the manufacturers, drug manufacturers, don't like the rebates, and the pharmacies don't like these pharmacy DIR rebates for probably obvious reasons. But where it hurts the consumer is that, especially a consumer, especially a senior in Medicare, who has Medicare Part D, the way it hurts them is that they're often paying a percentage of the cost of the drug. So the consumer's share of the cost. Well, the consumer's share is based on the price before the rebates. So the price before the manufacturer's rebate and before the pharmacy's rebate. So just to give a quick example, let's just say that someone on Medicare Part D, that they're paying, the total cost of the drug is $100 and their share is 25%. So they're paying 25% of $100, which would be $25. But in reality, after the manufacturer's rebate and after the pharmacy's rebate, that drug is really only costing maybe $60. So instead of the consumer paying 25% of $60, they're paying 25% of $100. So their costs are higher. It accelerates them, especially again, in Medicare Part D, there's something called the catastrophic phase. So when the consumer goes out of pocket, when they've paid a lot of money on their own, eventually the government will kick in some additional money. And that's called the catastrophic phase. Well, because they're paying more money, because the senior's paying more money, because they're paying off that higher cost versus the actual cost, they're pushed into the catastrophic phase quicker. So two quick things here. One, it costs the person who's taking the drug more money because they're paying all these dollars before they hit the catastrophic phase. And two, the catastrophic phase, that's when the government kicks in more money. But who's really paying when the government kicks in more money? Well, that's you, me, and every taxpayer in the United States. So it's really pharmacy DIR fees, and DIR fees are impacting seniors in Part D, as well as every taxpayer in the United States.
I just want to clarify this a little bit more, and I'm sorry to keep hammering it, but I've not actually heard it put like this. So I just want to put it to you like this and get your comment on it. Can you acknowledge these big companies are actually taking the consumer's personal money, obviously when they take the DIR pharmacy fee, because when a consumer completes that transaction, you know, pays their copay, then a few months later, you know, the PBM takes that DIR percentage fee back from the pharmacy, that the PBM is actually taking the consumer's money effectively without their knowledge?
Effectively, yes. And that's, you know, both the manufacturer and the pharmacy, they're actually victims of this as well, because they're actually asked to pay the rebate and they have to collect, the pharmacy does, the pharmacy has to collect the higher copay from the senior. So a lot of times it's the patient in the pharmacy saying, why does this cost so much? And the pharmacy's, you know, in a position where they have to explain it. But in reality, the pharmacy is in this very awkward position of having to take the higher amount from the consumer, and then also having to pay the PBM this rebate fee. So it cuts both the consumer and the pharmacy, and also the drug manufacturer. You know, there's usually not a lot of sympathies for the drug manufacturer, but they're also being held up in this rebate game as well.
And also my understanding is that the PBMs, you know, when they take these fees, obviously, from the pharmacies, it isn't straight away. Sometimes it can be like half a year down the road. So obviously, you know, the pharmacy is obviously trying to keep up on their own bookwork. But it's based on sort of like quality measures, which apparently a lot of the time these measures are unknown, they're unpredictable, they're inconsistent, and they're outside of even the pharmacy's control.
Yeah, Brian, that's a great point, because the PBMs will answer that pharmacy DIRs, as you said, are based on quality measures. And ostensibly, they're supposed to be, but instead of a carrot, you know, as you can use the carrot or stick approach, these pharmacy DIR fees are, there's no carrot involved. It's just, what's the size of the stick? Will it be a big stick to hit the pharmacy over the head, or only a less than big stick? There's no such thing as a small stick where the PBM hits the pharmacy over the head. So yes, quality measures. So for example, a quality measure is the patient taking a cholesterol lowering drug? Well, sometimes the pharmacist can ask the physician, talk to the patient. Have you taken this drug before? Is it something you'd be willing to take? May I talk to your physician? And oftentimes the pharmacist is able to influence this drug, which is helpful to the patient. Unfortunately, though, there are times, though, that the patient has already tried that drug, and maybe it's caused muscle weakness, or or maybe the patient has been able to lower their cholesterol through diet and exercise, or maybe their physician just says, no, I do not want my patient on that particular drug. In those cases, the pharmacy is penalized for something that it can't control. It's penalized with these higher pharmacy DIR fees that have to be paid to the PBM.
The other point to make as well is with this unpredictability, you know, with business as it is, regardless of COVID, just how businesses work, whether it's pharmacies or other small businesses, that unpredictability in, you know, the money that you have and your bottom line could be the difference between staying in business or going out of business.
That's correct. And pharmacy DIR fees have really, they've been around for about 4 to 5 years probably is when they've really started to pick up steam. And just in the last, I guess now it's just before the pandemic started, the 2 years before the pandemic started, 4%, that's 2,000 pharmacies, 4% of all pharmacies closed their doors forever. And many of those are small business independent pharmacies. And when those small businesses close, that means job loss, that means loss of access. Many of them are also the large chains too. So it's not just a situation where, this is just the small guys can't compete. The big guys have been hammered as well. You know, in fact, one of the big guys, Walgreens, if you look at the Dow 30 and the worst performing stocks of the Dow 30, it would be Walgreens, not this year, but in the previous year and the previous 5 years. And that's about the time pharmacy DIR started. So, you know, again, not a lot of sympathy for a major corporation making billions of dollars, but it's not just the small pharmacies that are getting clobbered with these pharmacy DIR fees. It's also the big guys too.
To the consumer who's listening to this, what can they do as well? Because everybody needs to get involved if we're going to see change. We can't just expect organizations like yourself to carry the burden of trying to get, you know, systemic change in this country. So what can consumers do to try and help themselves and to help you?
Yeah, that's maybe the most important question of all, Brian, because, you know, as pharmacies, we can make noise about it and highlight the situation and bring it to light. But ultimately, you know, I still believe, and I think we still are in a world where the consumer is always right. And so it's the consumer who has to raise their voice and demand better, for the consumer to raise their voice to their local officials to say, you know, look, we need something better than this PBM model that's causing my drug cost to increase. Why is it that the United States is the only country in the world that's handed over the prescription drug benefit to PBMs, and the United States pays the highest drug prices in the world? That's not a coincidence. And so consumers need to demand something different and better than this PBM model that's causing drug costs to go up.
Doug Hoy, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for opening our eyes to what is happening, obviously, to healthcare and the healthcare industry in general here in the country. We will continue the discussion with you without question over the coming months and years. But in the meantime, thank you for joining us on Connecticut East this week.
My pleasure, Brian.
It doesn't seem possible, but winter is just around the corner, and across the state, warming centres or shelters are beginning to open their doors. But with COVID-19 still very much in the picture, those centres are having to adopt state-mandated protocols about how many people they can look after to make sure they do not cause COVID-19 infections to spike. I recently visited the Wyndham Region No Freeze Project based in Willimantic to see for myself what changes they are having to make, and to talk to the organization's executive director, Avery Lenhart, about how she and her team will deal with what lies ahead.
Avery, thanks for joining us on Connecticut East this week.
Thank you for having me.
An important part of the year, we're heading obviously towards winter. Just tell us a little bit about what Wyndham Region No Freeze Project does.
We're an emergency shelter for adults that are experiencing homelessness in the Wyndham region. And we are a seasonal shelter, so we're open typically from November 1st until April 30th every year. But we also provide year-round services for hygiene if people need to come in and take showers. We also are connected to a number of other agencies in the region that help people get from homeless into housing. And we do a great deal of work in that area, helping people get connected to the services that they need and also to resolve their homelessness.
We've all been dealing with COVID-19, obviously, this year. How much has that impacted on your ability to, you know, provide those services?
Last spring, when COVID hit, we were really concerned about what to do in the shelter. A large congregate setting, lots of people in one space, was a big challenge for us. Fortunately, the state stepped in and supported us to go stay in a hotel in Mansfield, the Inn on Stores. And we had as many as 48 people a night there, double occupancy. But it gave everybody a chance to kind of socially distance themselves and stay connected to the services that they needed, but also be able to shelter in place and that kind of thing. That option has ended, and the state has been working on getting the people who are in hotels into housing. So we are working with agencies and other entities to support that effort to get people into housing. For the upcoming season, we will be in this shelter, but we'll be at a greatly reduced capacity. We normally have 30 beds in the shelter, and we also take what we call overflow. If we have more than 30 people come in, the additional people can sit in chairs for the night and stay warm and dry and comfortable. But this year, because of COVID, we won't be able to do that. We'll be limited to 15 beds here, and then we are in the process of trying to nail down a space that we can use for overflow where we'll have cots. There won't be showers there. People will be able to come here during the day for showers, but we will have space somewhere in the community where we can have maybe an additional 12 to 15 people.
Apart from the logistics that you've just mentioned there being imposed on you by COVID-19 protocols, has COVID-19 also sort of ramped up the amount of homelessness as well? Because we hear about people not being able to pay their mortgages or their rent, etc. I mean, what are you seeing here?
Right. Well, there is a moratorium on evictions through December. So, so far, we haven't had a huge flood of people that are suddenly experiencing homelessness because they couldn't pay their bills. However, we also know that there are plenty of people out there that are looking for assistance with this, who are calling us daily and saying that they need help catching up on their rent. And so because of that, we anticipate that there will be an uptick in people who are experiencing homelessness. We've seen some signs of it already. We've had people who have just simply left their places because they knew they weren't going to be able to pay, and they didn't want to rack up a huge bill or have an eviction on their record, which is makes it very hard to rent again. So we've had people who have left their circumstance and opted for homelessness, hoping that they can get some support that way.
I'm going to put this question to you, and hopefully you won't think it too odd, but people have the strangest ideas of, you know, what a homeless person looks like. So just tell us, I mean, you know, who does this affect? And when it comes to homeless people, who are you dealing with?
That's a great question. We have the people in our shelter, the people that we work with who are experiencing homelessness come from all walks of life. We have people who are extremely well educated. We have people who come from very affluent backgrounds. We have people from other places. We've had people here who have been immigrants into the community from other countries. And then we have people that are sometimes struggling with mental health or addiction or physical health needs that are not getting addressed for whatever reason. And so in most cases, it's somebody who has fallen through the cracks of the system, whatever the system is. So
it really is just it could be you or me. I mean, you know, if we were to fall on hard times, it just basically is anybody, isn't it?
Exactly. I think that people have a stereotypical idea that a homeless person is somebody who's either got a serious mental health issue that is not being addressed, or a substance abuse issue that is not being addressed. And while we do see people with those circumstances, that is not even I don't think the majority of people that we see, we have anybody from all walks of life come here. And now we see a lot more. I wish I had a statistic that could tell you, but we see a number of people now that are actually employed but are homeless because, for instance, if they're having to pay child support, it may make it that impossible for them to be able to afford an apartment. A huge bill like a big auto repair bill can be all it takes to make somebody homeless, or a healthcare situation can make somebody homeless. So we have people who are actually working that will be staying in the shelter.
And talking of the shelter, this is where we're doing the interview. It's your shelter on 75 Bridge Street in Willimantic. As we look around, a lot less beds, as you were saying, than there would normally be, and obviously lots of other work being done here to obviously help with sort of like social distancing. When people come here, I mean, you know, what's the protocol? What are they coming here for, and how are you helping them?
So most people come here because they need safety, and that's safety from the elements, safety from the cold, safety from the pandemic. So when they come in the door, we really stress safety with them, safety measures. Sometimes you have a big room full of people, it can be a little bit hazardous. And so we have people that come in. When they come in, we'll do screening with them for COVID. Everybody, of course, has to wear a mask. There's PPEs available for people. Our staff will be outfitted with PPEs. And we make sure that people are hand washing and hand sanitizing and that sort of thing. We also check bags. When people come in, we want to make sure that they're not bringing in anything unsafe, which would be maybe a substance, maybe a lot of people who have been camping carry knives. Understandably, we just don't want to have those in the space. So we'll take those things and we lock them up for the night. They can have them back when they leave in the morning. We're not interested in keeping those things. We just want to, again, make sure that this environment is safe. And then once they come in the door, then with COVID, we are going to expect them to stay in their beds or stay on their beds or stay close to their beds and not be congregating because, of course, we're trying to minimize the spread of germs as much as possible. If we have somebody who is symptomatic, we will ask them to get checked out by the medical professionals, and then we will provide a little space. We'll have a small space here available for somebody who is maybe waiting on test results, needing to quarantine. If somebody actually has a positive case, we will turn to the state and ask for their help to get that person into an isolated space away from here.
So obviously lots of protocols being put in place there, which is quite understandable. The other thing, I suppose, just to ask is the service is free. Would that be correct?
Yes.
Obviously, that's important to the people that use it as well.
Right.
Now, you said you don't have, and as I said, as we sit here, there aren't as many beds as there would normally be because of COVID. Are you looking for some, like, partners, you know, maybe locally? You mentioned earlier that, you know, obviously a hotel had been made available to you. That isn't now. But are you looking for slight partners and spaces across, you know, the city to try and assist you?
Yes. We're looking for anything like a church space or maybe a retail or office building that has open space available where we could just put in some cots. It will be probably reduced hours. I expect that people will be able to come in at 10 at night, stay until 7 a.m., just a warm space to be able to lie down on a cot and sleep for the night. And then during the day, we'll be able to use this space for warming, although we may also be looking for daytime warming space. We're cooperating with the Covenant Soup Kitchen. They're working on some daytime warming space. We expect that we will also be looking for it as well. So it could be here. We don't know yet.
And if anybody out there who's listening to this, you know, if they do have some space or they know of a space, who should they contact?
They should contact me, Avery Lenhart, at 860-450-1346 or at my email address, wyndham.nofreeze@gmail.com.
And just to remind everybody as well, the shelter opens as of 1st of November
right.
through until when?
We expect we'll stay open until April 30th. That's our typical year. Last year, we were open a little longer because of the hotel and coronavirus, but I think April 30th will be it for us this year.
Well, Avery Lenhardt, Executive Director of the Wyndham Region No Freeze Project, thank you ever so much for talking to us, and thank you obviously for being there for, you know, the people that need you in and around the Wyndham area.
Thank you so much.
And if you're a business or church based in the Willimantic area and have space in a building that you'd like to donate to help house local people, then visit the organisation's website for full contact details at wyndhamnofreeze.com.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, with the November 3rd election looming, a survey of town clerks and registrars in towns across southeast Connecticut shows that voters in the region have requested and returned ballots at a rate exceeding already high statewide totals. In many of the towns, that number is 75% or higher. In the day this week, Connecticut has been awarded $65 million in federal funding to begin the replacement of the 113-year-old Connecticut River Bridge that carries trains over the river between Old Lyme and Old Saybrook. The bridge, built in 1907, carries at least 56 trains every day, bringing Amtrak passengers from Virginia to Boston, moving commuters on the Shoreline East service, and giving passage to freight trains headed to Worcester and Providence. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, Joanne Marola-Martin knows there's quite a bit that goes into the election process the general public often doesn't see. People think the registrars do nothing all year, they then show up on election day, and magically the election happens, and that's not what it is, said Marola-Martin, the Norwich head moderator and former registrar of voters. Earlier in the summer, Connecticut Secretary of State Denise Merrill sent a press release announcing a statewide effort for recruiting for poll workers, a step made after other states around the country were having issues with securing them. Marola-Martin said the poll workers in Norwich are very experienced, so things run really well in the city. In the Middletown Press this week, local leaders are warning the public about a concerning trend in Middlesex County towns, which shows the average daily rate of coronavirus cases per 100,000 in five of its 15 municipalities is now in the orange zone. Connecticut uses a four-color system which groups COVID-19 positivity per 100,000 into gray, yellow, orange, and red. The pattern is echoed throughout the state. And in the Chronicle this week, during a pandemic that has turned the world upside down, a little kindness can go a long way. For the Wyndham Textile and History Museum, an offer from a neighbor helped it continue its recently completed Halloween programming this fall. Given the restrictions for museums during Phase 2, it was a challenge for the museum to offer its usual Nightmare on Main exhibit. Across the street, however, a large portion of the Wyndham Mills building is unfinished and vacant. Problem solved. And in next week's Connecticut East This Week, it's been a year since Governor Lamont requested the setting up of the PFAS task force here in the state to look at the problem associated with PFAS chemicals in firefighting foam and consumer products after tons of the dangerous chemical were inadvertently discharged into the Farmington River in 2019. But despite the task force being set up and the state's desire to deal with this health and environmental problem, what exactly has the task force done a year later? Connecticut East This Week talks with representatives from Connecticut DEEP and the Department of Public Health, two of the agencies on the task force, to find out. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow, and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott-Smith. Thank you for listening.